The two parables that we heard this morning are well known to most Christians. We learned them in Sunday school, we made sheep out of cotton balls, or we counted out 100 tiddlywinks to see how many was 100 and how many was 99. We I can remember counting dried beans to try and figure out how big a number that was, so that we could sort of get a feel for what it's like when a sheep is gone from the shepherd's flock. But this week I was reading a book that gave me a whole new perspective on these very familiar stories. The author's name is Amy Jill Levine, and she is a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University. And she describes herself as a Yankee Jewish feminist who teaches in a predominantly Protestant divinity school in the buckle of the Bible Belt. So here's this woman who's a faithful Jew, and her area of interest is the New Testament. And she's done a lot of really incredible work that has helped people to focus on the historical Jesus, the person, and the context in which he was living. When it comes to our gospel for today, Levine writes, both Matthew and Luke have provided our parables with a context, and in so doing, they have begun the process of interpretation. We do well, she says, to see what the parables might have meant prior to their reception as Matthew's instruction for church leaders and Luke's, we love tax collectors, but Pharisees not so much. In other words, what she's saying is that Matthew, when he sets up the story of the lost sheep, it follows Jesus' instructions to the disciples about how to care for little ones, about how to care for unimportant people, children, women, people who are sick. And so the story of the lost sheep then becomes not a proclamation so much as a lesson in paying attention to those who are under your care. In Luke, the parable is told in response to the Pharisees and religious leaders when they criticize Jesus for welcoming and eating with sinners. Levine's point is that in both cases, the gospel writers put the stories into a context that suited their purpose in writing, which doesn't mean that they did anything wrong, but as she said, they have begun the process of interpretation just in the way that they told the story, in the way that they set it up. Levine's interpretation takes the parables out of the surrounding text to try and understand what's at the very heart of what Jesus is trying to say. She writes, traditional interpretations see the sheep as the believer who has strayed from the fold. The one in search is Jesus or one of his representatives who makes every effort to save this lost sheep from destruction. And the friends who join in feasting at the end are the church. She says, this is an encouraging message. It is certainly good news. What has gotten lost, however, is any provocation, any challenge, and so a second listen is in order. Which person among you, having 100 sheep and losing one of them, wouldn't go and look for the lost lamb? The truth is that the majority of people in Jesus' audience would have said, not me. You leave the 99 to look for the one. When you come back, all you're going to have is one, because the other 99 will have disappeared. Both parables presuppose that the owners are people with some wealth, that you had 99 or 100 sheep. A peasant shepherd might have maybe 10 sheep at best, but never 100. This is an incredibly large flock. And the coin that the woman lost was equivalent to a year's wages. To have 10 coins all to herself, this would have been very unusual. Unusual for a woman to have one coin to herself, but to have 10? And so Levine says, 1 out of 100 is easy to overlook, but as soon as the owner recognizes his loss, he takes whatever steps are needed in order to bring the group to wholeness. Even a missing 1% must be noticed. And if he can notice the missing one and diligently seek to find it, he reminds listeners that perhaps they have lost something or someone as well, but have not noticed it. Before the search can begin, we need to notice what or who is not there. Over the centuries, many have interpreted these stories to mean that the owners of the sheep and the coin represent God and that the coins and the sheep are people, and that God has gone looking for us. But here's the problem with that. The Bible tells us again and again how God knows where we are, knows us before we were born, knows how many hairs are on the hairs of our head, knows that where we go, no matter how hard we might try to hide, we could go to the deepest depths, the highest place, wherever we go, the Bible says God will find us. So how is it that we could have been lost? You and I are not the coin and the sheep. The parables don't say that the sheep or the coin were misbehaving. It's the owners who have the problem. Levine says that rather than the parable of the lost sheep, the story could be called the parable of the initially oblivious owner. The panic, the searching, the finding, and the celebrating are all done by the owners. They are the focus of the stories. And although Luke says that the stories are about repentance and forgiveness, there is no sin in these stories. The sheep didn't recklessly wander off only to realize later that they needed to find their way back home. And the coin is an inanimate object. There's no way that it knew what it was lost. So here's the paragraph that stopped me in my tracks this week. Levine writes, "The parable presents a main figure, the owner, not the sheep, who realizes he has lost something of value to him. He notices the single missing sheep among the 99 in the wilderness, and for him, the missing sheep, whether it is 100 or a million, makes the flock incomplete. He engages in an exaggerated search, and when he has found the sheep, he engages in an equally exaggerated sense of rejoicing, first by himself and then with his friends and neighbors. If this fellow can experience such joy in finding one of 100 sheep, what joy do we experience when we have lost something and we find it? Moreover, if the owner can realize that one of his 100 has gone missing, do we know what might be missing? Do we know what or whom we have lost? When was the last time we took stock or counted up who was present rather than simply counted on their presence? Will we take responsibility for the losing? And what effort will we make to find it or him or her again?" The second parable includes those same themes of loss and search and discovery and joy. But the important difference between the shepherd and the woman comes in the way that they talk about their loss. The shepherd talks about my sheep, the lost one. He doesn't claim any responsibility for having anything that took place to make that sheep be lost. But the woman says of her coin, "The one I had lost." She claims responsibility. To which Levine says, we are provoked again. We can celebrate when what we have lost is found, but can we also admit our responsibility in the losing? We need to take count not only of our blessings, but also those of in our families and in our communities. And once we count, we need to act. Finding the lost, whether they are sheep or coins or people, takes work. It also requires our efforts, and from those efforts, there is a potential for wholeness and joy. So what have we lost? As a community, we have been tremendously fortunate, but have we kept track of our blessings and our family and our community? The church council has been reading a book called Canoeing the Mountains by Todd Bolsinger, and it's about Christian leadership in sort of uncharted territory, because right now we are in uncharted territory. And even though we're only on chapter 3 of this book, it has already given me a lot to think about. And one of the things that stood out for me this month were these two questions. What is the purpose of God's family? And the second is, what is the family business of the family of God? For me, these are critical questions for us to consider as we look together at our mission as a congregation and in our community and beyond. What is our purpose? What is our mission? We talk about being the light on the ridge, but are we shining as bright as we might? Are we attracting others to the light of Christ? If that's our business, how are we doing? Are we being a beacon to help people avoid the rocks and the shallows? Are we giving warmth to those who find the world to be a cold and cruel place? Is this the business of this family? And how are we doing? Currently, there are some things that could really benefit from the family's attention. The beloved community garden now has two raised bed boxes built with a third to come later in the fall. But have you gone outside to see them? They're beautiful. They are exact. They are level. They are remarkable. They are built on the side of a hill. Have you gone out and seen where the garden is? Do you have a sense of enthusiasm for that project? Is this a ministry that's going to be sustained by the work of a few people who came and built the boxes and have talked about it all summer long? Or is this a common mission with the ability to involve and engage people here and in the community beyond our congregation? Creating this garden was identified 2 years ago as a top priority, and I truly believe that this can be for us a game changer, that this could be a transformational ministry, but only if we work on it together, only if it is the work, not of a small team of people, but of the family of God. Have we lost sight of that goal? I hope that we haven't, but we need to find the enthusiasm from 2 years ago to use in building up that garden and continuing to look at how that is going to be able to feed people in our community. If it's going to succeed, it's got to be more than 8 people who are interested in growing food for hungry people. As Gary said, Sunday school begins today, but on Tuesday, we didn't have enough teachers to be truly effective or safe. We need to have 2 adults in every classroom. That is the requirement of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. On any given Sunday, we need a minimum of 12 adults to make it work. A minimum of 12. And that's not counting Jennifer, who makes sure that all the pieces are in place. What have we lost sight of that it was so hard to find people who are willing to teach Sunday school? The kids are lovable. The Christian education building is great. We have closets of resources. We have crayons and paper and terrific curriculum and all kinds of things going on. And most important of all, we have a really great story to teach to our children. If members of the church council hadn't volunteered on Tuesday night, we would have had to delay rally day or figure out how to restructure our Sunday school. What do we risk losing if we are not mindful about teaching the love of God to our children? It shouldn't be this difficult, but it is. Parents are overwhelmed at this time of year trying to figure out their kids' schedules and who goes where and when. And when I was a kid, you didn't put church down on your calendar, but now you have to do that to make sure you know which kid's playing soccer, who's got hockey practice, where are we going. Yes, we can go to Sunday school this week. How can this family be of help to those families who are trying to figure out how to keep all the plates spinning, and there are a lot of plates? Is a traditional Sunday school no longer necessary? Do we want to try to hold on to it, or do we lose it and replace it with something that might work better for us? These are questions we need to be talking about, and not just saying, well, we're going to do it the way we always did it. Maybe that's not the solution for us, but we have to ask, and we have to try. Last Sunday, the ELCA held God's Work, Our Hands Day. In our area, there are always multiple things that you can do on that day. It has been an annual tradition in the ELCA, and there were people all over the country wearing those ugly yellow t-shirts like I had on last Sunday. And yet, our participation in that has decreased every year. The crop walk is going to be held in October, and it simply isn't as popular as it once was. And this is an event that provides resources for people locally and nationally and internationally. It has been sharing food resources for more than 50 years. Over $8 million was raised last year, and there will be more than 800 crop walks in 2019. But are we going to support it? Either by walking or sponsoring a walker. It's a big deal. It's a very big project. But do you feel connected to that work? Do you feel connected to the needs of the people outside of this community, and what is it that we can do for them? Do we have bad timing? Is this just a bad time to ask people to do things? Is it that we need better advertising? Sometimes I think nobody reads the announcements in the bulletin. We talk about all of these things all the time, all of these ways that we can serve the people of God, and yet we seem to possibly maybe have lost track of something. Why is it so hard to ask people to get involved and then keep them involved? Have we lost our passion for these projects? All of these things should call us to look at how our family business is operating. And then we also need to look at the family itself. We have several people right now in our congregation who are facing critical health issues. Are we doing all that we can to care for them? Are their families getting the support that they need? And then there is the hard work that comes when we count our family. When you look around you and notice who's missing and who's here. What responsibility does this family have to look for folks who are no longer here? They didn't move away. They didn't, it isn't that they've found a new church somewhere else. They're at home on Sunday morning. Are we missing them? Do we notice that they're not here? And what about the new people in our community? There are little housing developments popping up all over Upper Bucks County. You go down some farm lane thinking you're heading off in the middle of nowhere, and then boom, there's like eight houses you never saw before. Those houses are filled with people who are looking for something. And they may be looking for what it is that we have here, but they will never know what's going on here if we don't tell them. Do we have something they need or want? I think that we do, but you got to share the message of grace in order for them to find out. Our family, the family that is Keller's Church, the family that yearns to be the light on the ridge, is made up of so many incredible people with tremendous gifts and hearts for giving in so many ways. You have so much to give. Each and every one of you has something to share. But if we lose sight of who we are and who we are meant to be, what's going to happen next? A lot of us are tired, weary from the capital campaign, and then there was the building project, and then there was all that stuff to get ready to have a new pastor, and then waiting for a new pastor to come, and then a new pastor finally arrives, and you have to figure out what kind of a crazy person she is, and how are we all going to work together, and now here we are in this moment, and we can't afford to say I'm too tired, or I've done my bit, or I'm done, because the work of God's family goes on and on and on. What will we do next? This is not the time to hide our light under a bushel. This is a time to figure out ways to make it shine brighter, to make it more inviting, to make it warmer, to carry that light out beyond the ridge so that more people will know the love of God in Christ Jesus. You have a gift to share. Don't lose hold of it.